Soho in the 1970s was a very special place. Most of the people who moved there did so because they didn't mind homesteading. The conditions were very, very primitive as a place to live. The lofts were abandoned warehouses, warehouses that had been abandoned by manufacturing. Most of the manufacturing left New York City over the previous decades, and consequently, New York's tax base suffered. So the city had no money to provide assistance to homeless people. They had no money to renovate any of the buildings. And this was just an empty, abandoned area. So they changed the law to allow small business to move in, and that allowed artists to move in as small businesses. And people came from all over the country, very diverse interests and media. There were dancers and poets, writers, as well as visual artists, filmmakers, performance artists. Although none of the people had goals in common, probably what we were opposed to in common. Most of the young people during that period were united in their anti-Vietnam War feeling. So most of us had suffered in some way at the hands of the government, because although we had protested legally for civil rights and against the war, the government was suspicious of us and our activities, and many of us had our phones tapped, and because the government had lied to us and we had just come out of the idealism of the 60s, we were very suspicious of all institutions and the government in particular. So we had that in common. Otherwise, I would say we really didn't have anything in common, except we were willing to live illegally in Soho. People would have hot plates that they could unplug from the wall if the building inspectors were going to come, and artists were constantly being thrown out of their lofts because it was not legal to live there. It was only legal to work there. So our beds we had to have covered in art, or we had to hide in some way. And that made us all kind of outlaws. We were sort of a group of outlaws. But there weren't very many of us. In fact, there were very few. I would say there were no more than 300 people in the area. And none of us had money. So our support system was our peer group. If I was going to have a show and needed assistance, I would ask one of my friends to help me. And in turn, they would ask me to be in their performances or to help carry something one place or another. And there were very few places to meet each other. There were a couple of bars, Finelli's or Max's Kansas City. And you would go there and see all kinds of artists. Robert Smithson was constantly there lecturing on his philosophies. And other artists would come and argue with him. It was usually rather loud, but always art-oriented. And Gordon had decided that we needed sort of a central meeting place. And with Jeffrey Liu, he helped organize the first cooperative gallery in Soho, which was called 112 Green Street. That was the address. And artists there was very, very casual. You could just go and put your work on the walls. And if someone else's work was there, you would arrange for them to remove their work after a week or 2 weeks or whatever, and then you'd put yours up, and then someone would come and arrange to put their work up. So it was very, very casual. And he also started Food Restaurant, which was, again, a place where people could gather and socialize, because there just weren't places you could do that. This was the first restaurant in Soho, and he invited artists on Sundays to come and cook. There were always guest cooks, like our friend Bob Rauschenberg would come, or Mark de Souvereau. There were a lot of artists who came in. In fact, sushi was introduced to the art world in a food restaurant. Everyone was shocked. They'd heard about this exotic food, and when they got there to eat it, they saw, much to their dismay, it was raw fish. Of course, now sushi is very, very popular. But he had started food restaurant with his girlfriend of that period, a lady named Carol Gooden, who had gotten a small inheritance from her family. And they had that for about a year and a half. Otherwise, people would meet, if anyone had any money, which was unlikely, people all had day jobs, driving taxis or doing construction, which is what Gordon did. If anyone had money, they would cook. And I knew if I was going to cook something and invite one friend, my one friend would invite everybody they knew. So I always had to prepare a large quantity, and I never knew who was going to come. After dinner, we would play records and dance. And that was another way that we got together. No one could afford to go into discotheques, and you know, bars got to be very expensive. And I remember walking down Worcester Street with Gordon, and I think Philip Glass was there, and Gene Heistein, and there was a group of artists, and Gordon said he had to get up early the next morning because he was putting up some walls in the loft across the street. And Philip Glass said, oh, really, I had just done the plumbing there. And Gene Heistein said, really, I'm putting the electric lights in the apartment over on this side of the street. And as we walked down the road, I realized all the lofts had been renovated by the artists. They were the people who made Soho ultimately livable. Food restaurant employed artists. It was another way of assisting the little art community. People could come in and work there for several weeks and earn enough money that they would be able to produce an artwork or a gallery show or a performance or whatever. And then they would stop working and create their art. And when it was all over and they wanted to come back, they usually could find employment again. And there's a list in, I think, the old Avalanche magazine that lists some of the artists who worked there. And it was actually the who's who of Soho. Because, as I said, no one had any money, so everybody was looking for some kind of employment to support their art. Well, because we had no money, any feedback that we got regarding the art was from our peers. And other artists were brutal in criticizing the art, and people were often devastated, and you would see them at bars or whatever, but you had them as an audience. If they wanted you to go see their show, you better come and see their, you know, your show. So there was a lot of criticism, and it made the work stronger. You would see every now and then these infectious ideas run through the art world like a fire or something. I remember Anthony McCall's film Line describing a cone. People saw that, and immediately that inspired all kinds of work. Or Alan Surratt, having done some of his architectural pieces, and inspired all kinds of copies. And artists were extremely concerned that they had done it first. That was the most valuable thing that they could think about their work, was they had done it first. With Gordon, even his friends were not quite sure what he was doing. They liked it. They thought it was really great, but they weren't sure if it was vandalism or art, if he was really just fooling around, or if he was actually seriously making something. And I think that was because Gordon was not intimidated by art or aesthetics. He had grown up in the middle of the surrealist group, exiled in New York City in the 40s. And, well, his father was a very famous surrealist painter, Roberto Matta. And when his father went back to New York, his mother was still very close to Isamu Noguchi and all of the abstract expressionists. So Gordon grew up with naughty adults who drank too much and broke things, but still made very clever things as a result, and everybody loved them anyway. And he saw what could result from playing. So he really had, I think by osmosis, an extraordinary art history background, although it wasn't so formal. But consequently, he had a more casual and confident approach to art and knowing what it meant to be an artist. Many people, in order to convince you that their art is great, you know, really have to, they write about it and talk about it. Gordon didn't. He just showed you something. And another interesting, unique aspect to Gordon's personality was his generosity, because he was willing to share and to invite everybody to participate in the artwork. And in New York, in that period, that was very unusual. When Gordon was filming, he would just hand the camera around, or photographing even. Many of his photographs were taken by people just standing next to him. Gordon was very political. He came from a political family. I believe Mata was out rioting in the streets with the students in 1968. Gordon was very political at Cornell University in New York. It was a political time. Our parents were completely alienated from us, or by us. We were alienated by the government, by all the institutions. We just didn't trust anyone over 30. There were horrible things happening around the world then, as there are now. And I believe we were much more personally engaged during that period. There's a difference in the United States, a huge difference between then and now, and that is the draft. Although this war is equally unpopular, but in the 70s and the 60s, every family in the United States was affected by the war because the young people were being drafted into Vietnam. So that mobilized everybody. Gordon's background, I think, made him engage more fully. His father had been on a hit list in Chile when Pinochet came into power. Mata was one of the people he wanted to assassinate because Mata had been a supporter of Allende. Gordon organized in 1971 a boycott of the Sao Paulo Biennale because of the military dictatorship there. They had recently imprisoned 30 architects who had proposed architectural solutions to some of the very serious social problems that they have down there. Gordon was horrified by what was happening in New York at the time. As I mentioned, New York City was bankrupt. It had no money to support the weakest members of the society. So the homeless people were just living out on the street. There were a lot of homeless people. The infrastructure was breaking down in the city. There was no money for reconstruction. The mayor at the time of New York City, Mayor Lindsay, complained that he spent as much time on the garbage crisis in New York as he spent on New York City's other problems in total. It was very difficult to walk down the street. You would see homeless people, and then you would see drug addicts. Because of the depression, people turned to drugs. It was a very difficult time, and Gordon really had a great heart. He was a great humanitarian. He felt he was an architect, or trained as an architect, and as a poor artist, one step away from being homeless himself. So he thought he should offer some solutions that his background had provided his skills for. So he proposed the garbage wall. It's a free, garbage is free, it's everywhere, except in Siena, of course. But we certainly had a lot of garbage in the 60s and 70s in New York City. And he proposed constructing the garbage in a more concrete form that could be used as a building element. Because in New York, we have very severely cold winters, and of course, cardboard boxes just melt in the rain, and that's what so many people were living in. So he thought if he could provide something that was free, or at least very cheap, the homeless would pick up on this idea and create these fabulous houses for themselves. He did that also with many of the broken bottles that were just lying around in the garbage on the streets. He gathered those together, and with a little burner, he found he could melt the glass and create bricks that would be a building element too. And he was very optimistic. He recreated these all over the city, hoping that the homeless would watch him, and he always, for these events, would prepare food like a pig roast or a side of beef. He would cook outside, hoping that this would attract the neighbors and that people, homeless people, would smell the cooking aromas and come in and want to be fed, and then he could talk to them and explain how they could create better housing for themselves. I'm afraid he was a little too optimistic. I don't know if any of the homeless people actually tried to make houses for themselves, none that I know of. Gordon was the son of Roberto Matta, the surrealist painter, who was recognized throughout most of the United States, or, well, at least the East Coast and Chicago, during the 40s. He was credited with teaching many of the American abstract expressionists the initial way to create a painting using splashes and drops of paint. And Matta was very social and engaged the other artists in New York at the time, in addition to the surrealists, Gorky and Motherwell, and many of the New York artists. Gordon grew up in the middle of that, so he was multilingual at an early age. His mother had these two twins, and of course, Matta was not really around when they were raised. He left after their birth. So she took the twins down to Chile to Matta's family, and they looked after the twins and his mother for a year and a half. And during that time, Matta heard many of the stories from the maids there about, you know, the Indian mythology and about Chilean life. And then he came back to America with his mother and continued to grow up in the middle of this art world. But he also spent many summers with his father and his father's wife, Malit Matta, both in Paris and here in Italy. So he had a kind of half-European upbringing. He went to school here for, I believe, 2 years at different periods of his time. He was at the Sorbonne for a little while. As I said, he was multilingual. He spoke French and Spanish and English, and he somehow got along in Italian, although I think there were a lot of faces made when he spoke Italian. He was quite comfortable traveling around Europe. He had European galleries very often because at that period, the Europeans were much more accepting of the type of artwork that was coming out of New York, and Gordon's work in particular. Americans were not interested in that. And architecture was a very casual group of friends who used to get together to talk about ideas and art. Many of them were minimal sculptors, but some of them were conceptual artists as well. Laurie Anderson was a performance artist. I think an architecture probably was most useful for Gordon in working out ideas, discussing them with his friends. He certainly had a very strong vision of what it was, which did not necessarily agree with what the other members felt it was. Many of the other members weren't quite sure what it was. And if you ask them today, they'll say, well, we were never really sure and it was never really defined, but I think it was actually in Gordon's mind. The exhibition came about because 112 Greene Street had a period with nothing on the walls, so they immediately scrambled to try to create something out of what their discussions had been, and the idea was that the format would be all the same, 16 by 20 photographs, and the exhibition would be anonymous, and they had to put it up on the walls immediately. And typically, because it was a combination of anarchy and architecture, and artists were involved. Anarchy reigned. Not only were they not all photographs, some of them were original drawings, but they weren't all 16 by 20 either. So the rules, every rule that they made was broken. A lot of people have noticed Gordon was a great dancer. I always say that gravity didn't affect him like it affects the rest of the world. I think he danced through his whole life in some way. He was a very physical person, but also very graceful. And I think because of his multicultural background and his ability to speak different languages, it gave him a certain agility of mind. Architectural training does that too. It gives you a way of understanding, conceptualizing space that is more profound than the rest of us. And so Gordon moved through space in a different way. He conceived of space in a different way. Often terrifying me, I remember when he did Jacob's Ladder. We had woven the network together in a huge conference room at a hotel and castle. But he went to, he climbed up the side of the smokestack and was hanging there by his knees, pulling this damn net up all by himself. I couldn't even look at it. It was so terrifying. I was sure he was going to die. And then once it was up, he was so happy with it, he thought, oh, all the people, all the spectators at Documenta are going to want to climb up this and see the rest of Castle and Documenta from this altitude. It'll be wonderful. And in some of the photos, you can see the people down below the net on the ground looking up at him, terrified. Of course, I was obliged to climb up because I was his girlfriend. You know, the things you do for love, I think now. But the loft parties provided a lot of good outlet for young energy. And I see now dances by Twyla Tharp and Lucinda Childs and Trisha Brown. Many of the artists really got a lot of their moves from our casual moves dancing on the floor, because people were always jumping up after a loft party. You would see footprints on the walls and often the ceilings, and Gordon would lift people up and toss them up and catch them. He was something. But I think that he liked engaging people, and a lot of the sculpture wouldn't work unless you were engaged. You had to move through these spaces too, and that was the piece. As you moved through it, the work would change in time and in space. And this was a kind of new way to look at sculpture, not in the safety of a museum, but out in some very inconvenient spot like Englewood, New Jersey. He knew if you went to Englewood, New Jersey, that you would be more receptive to going into the building. There's another interesting aspect of the building work, which you really only get in the films now. People visiting his sculpture had a very intimate relationship with the artist, because in walking through one of his pieces, you really had to decide yourself if you had confidence in this man that he knew what he was doing architecturally, because some of these cuts were so extraordinary, it looked like, you know, the whole building would fall down. And did you trust him, and did you trust yourself enough to step over a cut in the floor that might be a hole that led six floors down if you made the wrong step? So your senses were heightened primarily because of fear, and being afraid, you were much more aware of the air currents, which were unusual because of the cuts in different places. you were aware that you could observe people on the street in unexpected ways, but at the same time they could observe you in unexpected ways. You were aware of the shape of the light coming through the roof, perhaps, or maybe it was the rain, the way it would move through the different floors of the building. It was really quite a sensual experience for the viewer. Again, it was like the viewer was dancing through space. And you today can only get that in the film. You don't have a sense of the fear of actually walking through the space yourself. When Gordon died, he told me he didn't think that he had made enough work, and virtually no one saw the work. Only a handful of friends were ever allowed into the buildings because they were dangerous or in inconvenient locations. Not very many people knew him. And he told me I could throw it all away if I wanted to. He didn't, you know, if it was inconvenient to keep, or I could sell it if I wanted to. And he hoped we would give some of the money to artists, which we have done continually since he's died. We've supported other artists with his work. He wanted to engage people in the art. This was difficult because often the building cuts were torn down immediately, or once they were completed, it was illegal for people to enter them. For instance, in Antwerp, friends would go in, but you couldn't make it official. It was not an official opening where people could walk through. The same in Chicago, even though it was done in a museum, because it was dangerous to the general public. The general public was not allowed in. So Gordon did not have confidence that a lot of people saw the work. He used performance as a way to bring people into the work. One of his favorite projects was Conical Intersect because it was open onto the street. So people would drive out of their way in the morning going to work and coming home from work to look up and see what this madman was doing up there. And he loved that. And he wore his blue overalls and brought his baguette and his little bottle of watered wine and would sit out on the street for lunch with the other workers in the neighborhood when the whole neighborhood was being reworked. He loved that, and he really wanted people to engage in the work. So he often used performance or food as a way to attract attention to the work. Otherwise, he felt no one would see it. Many of his friends said they never knew what Gordon was talking about. He had a wonderful way with language. He was extremely intelligent, and as we know, he was well-traveled and multilingual. He had been exposed to things like the Situationalists in Paris and here in Italy, and in New York, most people didn't know about that. When Gordon spoke, it was kind of with a gestalt approach to language. He would mix in words, he would create new words the way the Surrealists did. His father, if you look at the titles of his father's paintings, you'll see there are many invented words there, and the same in Gordon's work. You'll see many of the titles are a combination of different works, like An Architecture. And he was creative in his speech, so and dialectic. I met a critic who was a very linear thinker who said he never had any idea what Gordon was talking about, and after talking with this critic for 5 minutes, I could understand it. Gordon was making spirals with his language, and the linear critic was just stuck on the ground watching incomprehensibly. I'm thrilled when I see young artists working in similar areas in the areas that Gordon had worked in. Gordon was very generous, and in fact, he was a little annoying sometimes. He would go out to buy the newspaper in the morning, and he would always come back with someone. Many times an art student or just somebody picked up on the street. He came back with a nuclear physicist once. It was, you know, and I was there at home doing my work, but then we would have these people in the house. And Gordon was always talking to them, trying to sell them on the idea of art and how important it is to have art in your quest, in your life, that art raises the level of a conversation. And I so agree. I think he would be so proud that so many people have looked to his work and found it stimulating and inspiring to continue in some of the directions he explored.